Welcome to Combox. Jared Kimber here for the Wagon Wheel Show, which is your chance to ask questions and get them answered. If you're watching live, you can always do that via YouTube, where you can put in a super chat at any stage, or you can support us on Patreon. You can go to Good Areas Podcast there and support us and ask your questions like Adityan has. And he says, did people do something to the speed gun this time? Everybody's clicking faster than normal speeds. Hazelwood is constantly bowling 140s. Rabada hit 150. Tiagi is bowling late 140s. All of this is believable, but someone is certainly gaslighting me if Overton is hitting 150. To be fair, Overton has, you know, legit bowled fast in his life before. So I understand why you're asking that question. But I've seen him bowl very, very fast, especially when he was younger, before all the injuries started lining up, when the few times he was ever fit. The bowling speeds are what they are. You know, it's been a long-running joke in English cricket that players seem to bowl a lot quicker on Sky than they do when they are privately tested. No one knows exactly who's making that decision or what's happening. And I've never really truly understood it because of the way that Hawkeye works and the way it calculates. But yeah, in general, there are certain broadcasts at certain times where they do give you the hot speed gun. And this is from people I know who have worked, you know, inside of cricket, you know, directly in these sorts of situations before. It's quite well known. Could have just been that they've decided to do that this year. But I don't know. I agree with you, though. There's quite a few guys who look like, you know, even though I remember seeing Rabada hitting 150. I don't think I noticed it for Hazelwood, but I certainly saw it with Rabada and thought to myself, I don't know. There's a couple of other times when people have bowled what I thought are more regular deliveries that have been 3 or 4 Ks quicker, but, you know, these things happen, I suppose. Sam says, do you think the impact player rule in the IPL overly affects the natural dynamics of cricket, as in team selection, the tactical balance of the side, and more broadly the game? I find myself rooting for every impact player to fail because I dislike it so much. I often think teams would be better not using it at times. I'm not sure you'd be better not using it. Do you think the way it's implemented is slightly weird, particularly when teams bring on an extra batter to bolster their batting lineup, usually because of a collapse? Or anything else. The way it's implemented, I don't like. I've said that from the start. If you're going to have substitutions, have substitutions. This is like the old super sub that the ICC tried. Either do it or don't do it. It's a bit like the nonsense that's going on in county cricket at the moment with injury substitutions, which is by far one of the stupidest things and is having exactly the expected issues that I have written about and done videos on many times before. We all knew this was going to be a problem. Shocking that they didn't think about this before. Anyway, let's get away from that for a minute. I've just done a video on this, Sam. It'll probably be up next week, but me and Varun are also doing a chat about it. There's no doubt that it has changed the way that T20 cricket is played, which is fine. Like, things can change the way that somebody is played for the better. I think specifically at the moment, it's what is happening right now is that kind of all the runs are at the front. And then you have this kind of like slow decline throughout the rest of the innings for many different reasons. I think that is happening. One is if you hit so many fours and sixes at the front of an innings, you soften the ball. And so it gets harder to hit fours and sixes in the later overs. And even when they have the replacement ball, it still doesn't seem to be happening, which I think also tells you that teams are much better at bowling defensively now than they ever have been, because they have to be. So I would say the quality of hitting has gone up and the quality of defensive bowling has gone up. And so you have this fascinating situation where so often now you see a team be 60 without loss after the power play and you think, wow, how many are they going to make? And it's generally 200. Sometimes it's slightly less than 200. This is the first league in history where the power play run rate is quicker than the rest of the innings run rate. It's never ever happened before until this year. There's plenty of stuff in the video about it. Also, I have no problem with substitutions, but this particular substitution doesn't really help bowling. And I think there's ways we can help bowling specifically as well. Many issues with it. But yeah, definitely has changed the game. Hertz says, Tilak is an incredibly talented batter who shows suboptimal performance against certain types of bowling. How does a coach go about making adjustments without compromising what's already working, especially in the middle of a hectic season? We call this hot fix in corporate. Is it even possible in a busy cricket season? It's really hard to get someone to change the way they play in a season. Tillack's going to be on a plane a lot of times. He's going to be going between hotels. They do a bit of practice, but they don't do a crazy amount of practice. And you're talking about a fundamental change to how he plays. The one thing I would say is you can make adjustments without compromising what's already working for Tillack, because this isn't like when Babar Azam changed his technique and when we've seen other players change their technique and cause an issue. He's already playing fine against pace, so there's no reason to change anything against pace. What you're really trying to find for him against spin is probably, let's call it the Jason Roy ruling, where Jason Roy was really struggling with the ball spinning away and he just starts reverse sweeping, right? That's one shot he had to learn, and he just had to commit to it for a period of time, which completely changes where they put the fielders, which now allows him to either get cheap runs on the reverse or they put a fielder out for the reverse, which allows him to punt the ball back down the ground again. Right. Again, making someone do that in the middle of a season is really, really tough. I just think that if they have to have a conversation with him, either they have to say, we think there's better usage of you than you facing spin if you're not going to be able to score quickly off spin, and we want to optimize you, and then let's spend the next 10 months of the year getting you into a position where you're no longer pinned down by spin. It really is as simple as that. He doesn't have to be great against spin. It'd be fantastic if he could get that. He just has to be at a position where he can't be pinned down by it, right? That's the Jason Roy thing I was just talking about a moment ago. It's as simple as that. Reese says, does Lara's open face play a big factor in his ability to find the gaps, or is it just a coincidence? No, so what Lara had is, because he has the ability to hit the very center of the bat more than most other players ever would, and he then has this incredible flexibility through that, he has the ability to play with a very open face, but also he actually plays with a very closed face. So if you have a look, Reese, he quite often gets a lot of boundaries, very, very fine to find leg. He's very good at that shot off pace and spin at times, right? And he can also take the ball from outside off stump and flick it to backward square leg. So what he's really doing is he's opening and closing the face quite regularly, which means that his main talent is then knowing when the ball hits that face, if he's going to get it past the fielder, right? So it's all well and good to be able to open and close the face, but that doesn't matter if you just keep picking out backward square leg over and over again, right? You're taking a risk without getting the runs, and you need the runs because you are already taking a risk by closing and opening the face. And so in Lara's case, it's the fact that he can do that, but do it almost mathematically to find the gaps that actually helps him there. Oh, this is a question. Hayden says, would it be appropriate to say that multi-format cricketers are amongst the most adaptable athletes? Transferable skills, mental approach. The best comparison I could think of is rugby with 7-a-side versus 15-a-side. Cricketers are expected to transition between formats in only weeks. I suppose how different is it, Hayden, than what tennis players used to do when there were, five different courts? So there was hard court, carpet, clay, grass, I suppose four different courts. Are they the only ones, or am I missing another one that I've just forgotten about? Like, how different is that when you might have to do a similar thing? Maybe they didn't do it quite as often. So I just think that's built into the sport, and it's built into cricket. You know, the sport that I've compared cricket to the most when we're talking about this kind of stuff, Hayden, is car racing, right? And we have seen that car races, that racing car drivers can switch between formats. I think there was an Australian guy who might have done Indy 500, truck racing, monster supercars in Australia, and something else somewhere else, right? Now, would he be able to do that from week to week to week? I don't know. But once that becomes like your life, then everyone has to do it, and lots of people do it. I think it probably becomes more natural at that point. So yeah, I think that, you know, there is certainly an element of what you're saying is correct. But it's one of those things of, so people will say to me, I can't believe you broadcast for, and this professional broadcasters will say things like, I can't believe you can broadcast for 6 or 7 hours in a row without taking a break at times, right? And they are right. But if they did it all the time, they would be able to do it too. So I think you're right, but also I think it's the way, at a certain point, you just get conditioned to do that, right? Satchmo says, Viva had a similar strike rate in tests and ODIs, but that was an era before power plays. Was it before power plays? Well, it certainly had the field up. I mean, I suppose he would have played quite a bit in power plays, wouldn't he, Satchmo? If I'm not mistaken. Well, he certainly would have been Kerry Packer's cricket. So we'd have to see what the strike rate differential is between him in Kerry Packer's cricket and internationals. In what ways Whitey might have changed his approach under today's playing conditions? I don't think there's much of a difference that he would have with Viv Richards other than he would score quicker now. So if he played now, he'd be the faster scorer, right? Like, let's say that. I think the impact sub would be quite interesting because we saw innings where he would come out and just hit a four almost every ball to start an innings. And he would then retract, which is what is kind of how they were trained, right? That's how even attacking players were, you know, that's why a lot of we had players who could attack and score lots of boundaries. But it's why things like, you know, Gilbert Jessop's record and some of those other really fast scoring games are rare. It's not that it's because if you hit a bunch of boundaries, you would pull back, right? There's plenty of stories about that from attacking players who were completely on top. So, and that was before the days of boundary riders and everything as well, and slower balls, right? So I do think that if you put him in modern T20, especially in the impact sub era, you would probably be, he's probably like a Virat Kohli who can score in more unconventional areas with more power, who's playing with Phil Salt's intent. Is probably what Viv Richards is in this era, if he comes through. But I'm trying to think of other regulations. And the only other thing I would say if he played in like modern T20 cricket would be that I think, like a lot of these guys, he would understand that the best time to hit boundaries is early on. So he would absolutely massacre the ball early on and keep going until essentially you couldn't hit boundaries anymore. Mob says, if we look at all the players blessed to be playing in either the PSL or the IPL, are we able to say the IPL cohort is a cut and dry tier above the PSL cohort? Put it another way, are there any foreign players in the PSL this year who should be playing in the IPL and vice versa? Yeah, I think, you know, you like someone like David Payne, who's playing in the IPL this year, is probably, at this stage of his career, is probably a PSL level player, right? Glenn Phillips has been in the IPL for a long time without truly cracking it, although he's barely played any games. But you could argue that he might be a PSL level player. There are players who sort of get stuck, you know, maybe play bad in the IPL once or twice and they don't get another chance. You know, let's call that the Lou Ronke effect. There are probably, you know, with India's ability to find spinners easier than Pakistan traditionally and certainly of recent times, there might be an element that there are spinners who play in the IPL who don't get picked up in the IPL because the owners think that, or the management think, there are more spinners available to them domestically, so some of those really good spinners might end up in the PSL. There are obviously Pakistani players who can play in the PSL, but yeah, the IPL is clearly a level above. There's no way of not thinking that. Ali says, following on last week's question, but what is the argument against franchise teams buying first-class teams for four-day matches? Wouldn't all boards benefit from privatising domestic first-class cricket? Yeah, but someone has to want to buy them. Is it monetizable? Right? So I think if I was talking to a private equity firm, I could say, look, what you have here is, let's say it costs $5 million. I have no idea, by the way. But let's say it costs $5 million to set up a first-class team, right? And I don't know, what's the average amount of games? Is probably 10, right? So you play 10 games, so that's 40 days of cricket, which is what, 320 hours of broadcasting. You've got your wraparound coverage, you've got your interviews, you've got everything else. If you went to a PE firm and said, we can broadcast all this, We can make it look a little bit good. And for 5 years, you will have to pay this amount for your first class team. But at the end of that, if you actually help us make sure that the broadcast is better, there's a little bit more promotion. Everyone knows that they can watch this game. If we're being honest now with PE firms, it probably have something to do with prop bet markets or betting as well. Whatever that may be, if there's a way of making, you know, $7 to $8 million a year, right, over that 5 year period, and then at the end you can sell it for more, that makes sense. But I don't really know where that goes. Like, how does that is? Are they going to make any money off that? Is there a benefit to the owners? I mean, you're saying more exposure for existing owners. Isn't it a different marketplace though? It's a different, is it helping your brand? Is it a way to do that? Is it worth it? I think there are far better things to invest in than first class. You know, I'm just off the top of my head. PJ says, if you could sit down and interview Shane Warne and Dean Jones today, what kind of questions would you ask them? So I've interviewed Shane Warne many, many years back now. I never interviewed Dean Jones. I think if it was Dean Jones, I did a really long interview with Ricky Ponting that must have been an hour and a half. And I'm not sure if Cricketfo ever put up the full video, but I think we put up a transcript of it. Maybe 3,000 or 4,000 words that you could find somewhere. I think I would make, I think in the Ricky Ponting one, what I was really trying to get to was the evolution of one day cricket, and Ponting was great on that. But I would want to do the same interview if possible with Dean Jones and probably with Javed Miandad. So I'd love to do the evolution of those three guys. Maybe Butler or AB after that would be the guy as well. Maybe even Kohli, all those sorts of guys. I'd love to sit them all down and just be like, great, let me take you through this. And then find a few, you know, maybe get Viv and Klusner, Yusuf Pathan, you know, Virender Sehwag, Glenn Maxwell type guys as well. One day I'd love to be able to do that. I'm not, you know, it might take me a long time to be able to do it, but I think Dean Jones would fit in that very much. Shane Warne, I think one of the things I wanted to ask him is, does he think that because he was such a physical outlier that leg spin actually didn't take a jump forward after Shane Warne? I mean, it eventually has, but certainly not at that time because so many people copied his action. And does he wish, you know, does he wish that maybe other actions had come through as well? And so certainly in the Western countries, I have a lot of leg spinners who tried to bowl like Shane Warne and just physically couldn't. I would love to talk to him about Craig Howard and about the why he thought Craig Howard was a better leg spinner than him, despite the fact that Craig Howard never made it as a leg spinner. I'd like to talk about the first era before the shoulder injury and the era after the shoulder injury and which one he thought he was a better bowler in. I think those are the major ones that I'd like to go through. As I said, I interviewed him once. We were supposed to have like a 15-minute interview. He did about 35, 40 minutes because we just asked him. It was me and Dan Bredick, and we just kept asking questions about leg spin. And sadly, neither me nor Dan, and Cricinfo seems to have taken down the article or the interview or whatever it may be, and we can't find it. So if anyone can find the video that we made or the article that was written from it or whatever that may be. But that was a big thing for both of us to be able to sit down with him. And I probably... It's very hard to sort of, you had to sort of get him around a sponsorship or around something he was releasing. I think if I was a little bit more diligent with that stuff in that era of my career, and I was really busy as well anyway, but if I was a bit more diligent, I might have like waited for like a new sponsor and just gone back to him 3 or 4 times and then kind of ended up with like a mini Shane Warne Diaries out of it. Let's just have a quick break. I think I can get one break in here before everything else. And we'll be back in a moment. Cricket boards actually make watching their games almost impossible now. I spend almost as much time trying to find where I can view it as I do actually following the action. That is why I use NordVPN. They let me find all the cricket I want to watch while protecting me from the nasty side of the internet. Nord will free your cricket matches. Grab your exclusive NordVPN deal by going to nordvpn.com/goodareas to get a huge discount off your NordVPN plan plus 4 additional months on top. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Watch every match with NordVPN. Abe says, seeing Jitesh Sharma struggle with the bat, but do really well behind the stumps raises a question. Is there still value in playing a specialist keeper in the IPL, especially in the Impact era sub, or is that irrational now? I still truly believe that we will come to a position where we will eventually work out that we could keep, even a specialist wicketkeeper might have some value. But until we can work out a way, and we can, we already know what the way is, we just don't use it. But until we use spatial tracking data to actually tell us what a keeper does, you know, whether they're a plus or a minus and how much of a plus or a minus that they are, I just don't think you make that decision at the moment. It would be, you know, there's two big issues. One is, I think the greatest specialist wicketkeepers in the world aren't even getting anywhere near professional cricket level, right? So even when you see a fantastic keeper like a Ridderman Zaha come through, when he has a batting average of like 30, I'm like, there might be 10 other wicketkeepers in India who are better than him who average like 15, right? Or didn't even get professional contracts because they couldn't hit the ball off the square. So I think that is one issue. And so I'm not sure if we're ever going to go back. Perhaps we might have and I talked about this before, you know, a sort of the anti-Adam Gilchrist, right? You know, the sort of Seymour Clark, Bob Taylor, Jack Russell, Darren Berry guy who comes through and is just, it is so clear that he is worth so much runs to his team. I think it was the Finland ice hockey goalkeepers who started catching the puck rather than deflecting the puck. And it turned out that in catching the puck, you actually took away a lot of rebound goals, right? So just in a simple technical change, if we had a wicketkeeper who could have that kind of an impact for whatever reason in the same way, and we could work it out. I think so many people in cricket want specialist wicketkeepers back. And I can tell you that most of those people are bowlers. Ajit says, it doesn't get talked about as much as Jaiswal Suryavanshi, but Prabhsimran Arya, there's something fun and exciting with Litchfield and Volbat together. They're great individually alone, but as a partnership, they're probably not as dramatic as the two pairs I mentioned as much, but they give a bit of Mahela Sangha vibes or Faf, AB, Rohit, Virat. Do you have any thought on this? Are there any other young partnerships in women's cricket now that have caught your eye? No, I don't think I'm as natural with this as other people are. I think my brain probably works in a slightly different way. And I think other people look for that partnership style. And it's not something that I, you know, automatically come up with. So I can't think of any. But even if like if I would, Susie Bates, is it Plimpton? And that's not a young one either, by the way. But it's usually the opening. It's usually the opening partnership. It's not Plimpton, is it? Who opens the batting with Susie Bates? I think in that perspective, I'm just automatically drawn to who the openers are, and then it kind of goes from there, right? And that is the way that I would look at it. Plimpton. I had Georgia as well. That was a partnership that I was really fascinated in for a while. I'm trying to think if there's any others. Partnership-wise, I can't think of any off the top of my head. To be honest, women's cricket has moved out of my brain at the moment, right? And it's about to move right back into my brain, but that's kind of how I do things. So sometimes, you know, making those connections is a little bit tougher on me. Gaji says, I know you spoke some about Muzrabani during the watch-along, but is it normal for a franchise not to give a contract for 2 weeks? If I don't get a contract, I don't take a verbal email as word because they won't pay at standing court. I read someone else that said players sign after they arrive in playing country. That sounds absurd. Oh, Gaji. I have a million things to say about this. I worked for Melbourne Stars, I want to say for 2 or 3 weeks before they gave me a contract. Melbourne Stars is owned by Cricket Australia. Cricket Australia and I have not always been on the best possible relationship because of some of my work. On top of that, I'm a journalist and I was getting inside information about what was happening at Cricket Australia from working there. And they never even got me to sign a contract for weeks. Forget the money side of things. That's one of the better run franchise systems in the world. Yeah, I think usually you would sign a contract before you get to a country. You got to remember that the players themselves are not always powerful, but the agents become a big deal here. So you don't want to be in a situation, and I don't know who, I know Blessing's agent sent a message out the other day, but I didn't see who his agent was. You do not want to be in a situation where you have an agent who is suddenly saying, I'm not going to send players to this owner, this team, this league. That can cause lots of issues, especially if they become, if they're a major player or they have a bunch of really good players. So things like that, there's almost a mutually assured destruction within this, Gaji. Having said that, it does cause problems. It can cause problems with visas. It's one of the many visa issues that cricket has. It does cause problems with like you get a contract at the last minute and you're playing a game in like a day's time and you might want something into the contract, but it's very hard to change that contract. There's so many different things that happen, but you're 100% right. You know, these things do happen. I'm owed by three franchises, one of which doesn't exist anymore, one of which has completely changed ownership and will never pay me. Another one which was subsumed and didn't really, I don't know if you'd say it doesn't exist anymore, but kind of changed the way it was run. And that was with contracts. So like in cricket, I'm not sure the contracts are worth all that much. The real issue at the moment is the players don't really have the power. But yeah, some of these leagues are terrible at this. And there is a lot of word of mouth and trust. But I think if you go back, Gaji, I wrote this piece on Cricket Info during lockdown about the percentage of players who had talked about their pay being minimum of 3 months late. And I think it was 65% of all cricketers in the world that were looked into. Was it the Indian cricketers weren't paid for a while? The Sri Lankan cricketers multiple times have not been played. The Pakistani cricketers have not been paid. Associate cricket, this has happened right across the board. These are the contracts that are easier to pay, right? This is your staff members should be. So imagine what happens when you get to franchise leagues. I don't know if this is out, so I won't say the person, but I know someone who was supposed to be working at a franchise league recently. I think the league didn't go ahead, but I'm not 100% sure, but who literally turned up to the airport and then didn't find, and their flight wasn't there. And so they rang up and they were told, oh yeah, we don't need you anymore. He's like, but I've planned to come over for 2 weeks and I've got a visa and I'm at the airport. It's a wild west. It is so unprofessional cricket. And the boards hate it when I go on and on about this, but it's their fault. They don't care. And because they don't care, no one else cares. Hurt says, nice piece on the muted mutant. I do think teams, coaches, and analysts are doing enough to identify player patterns and optimize their usage in today's game. On the flip side, how much of a sample data is truly enough before drawing conclusions on a young player without risking typecasting them before they are fully developed? I think teams are... It's still hard. It's a fascinating sport, cricket. And because of pitches, things change so dramatically. I think we're much better at understanding now through data and the amount of, video that we have, what players' strengths and weaknesses are much quicker, and we can help them get better at the things they're not good at, but also, more importantly, use them at the things they already are good at to get the most out of them. And, you get this situation, it doesn't matter how much data you have. Like, if your team is poorly put together or you have injuries or someone's out of form, players always end up out of position anyway. It's the dream when everyone fits in exactly as you want them to fit in, right? So there's no doubt that is a little bit of an issue at the moment. As far as with younger players, the patterns are actually pretty clear after about 200 balls. I think then what you also want to do is you want to go match that back with video. But if you're in the nets, you should be able to look at the same sort of patterns, right? So if you had a younger player that has quite strong patterns, then you would say, okay, we think we're onto something here. Let's use them this way. But the other thing is, I think when Moneyball first came around, my issue with it as a strategy was not that it didn't make sense, was that they were using the data and the information made sense, but this idea that players can't change and so you need to get rid of them doesn't make sense, right? Or that you can't educate players into what you want them to be. So the Moneyball revolution was great, but it was kind of treating players like stocks. Whereas actually what it should be is saying, okay, we now have a lot of information about you. You're doing this at the moment. We would like you to do this in the future. Can we work with you? So I almost think that instead of you finding bargains, it should be about, can we make your players better? And it's the one thing that cricket has had a real issue with while I've been involved, is that too often the data is used for opposition research when actually you can, if I've got a young seam bowler who bowls 138 kilometers with a good slow ball and they dominate right-handed batters and get smashed by left-handers, we're going to struggle to use that really good player in a game. I should be using my data and my analyst ability, and the video coordinator and the coaches should be using all their skills to see if we can turn that player into someone who is at least par on the other side of the ball. Because if you're a star in one or two things and you're par at the rest, you're a star. It's that simple. And so I think that is something that cricket has got wrong quite a bit. And I think, so I would probably say with a younger player, it would be the same thing. Okay, so at the moment, I remember, I think it was Muhammad Harris. Muhammad Harris came through in Pakistan. Everyone was really excited. And I can't remember what it was now. I can't remember if it was all right arm seam or if it was just seam in general. But it was really clear to me that he was whacking seam and whatever. And I might have the pattern wrong now because this was 5-6 years ago when I looked at it. Everything else, not as good, right? So the bad way of looking at that is, oh, we can't pick him, or we can only pick him and use him in this way. The good way is, okay, there must be patterns within his spin hitting or his left arm seam bowling hitting that works. Can we get him to score really quick so that no one wants to put them on, even though he goes out a lot? Can we get him to stay in really long and rotate the strike brilliantly off them, even if he doesn't score really quick? Like, are there things, you know, can he hit one kind of spin? And so if this team has them, we can actually, you know, tell him, don't go as hard against the pace today because you've got a good matchup coming up later. And then can we get him, you know, shots to get him off strike or whatever those patterns are. And so in order to do that, you need a really thorough database of every player. And I think the better teams are doing this, and a lot of other teams don't quite do it. And it should start when they're young so that you know as much about them as early as possible. Reese, how would you advise improving as a low-level club batter? Pitches are so different to nets. Most of the time, horrendously slow and low. I'm not sure I'm a great example of this because I have no patience. I would say on the wickets in that I've played on, the really bad English wickets, and which is what I think you're talking about here, but anyone who plays on bad club wickets will know what I'm talking about anywhere in the world. I think the bigger issue that you really want to do is there are always ways of just, it's not that hard to find ones and twos. And I think club cricketers in general kind of think in boundaries. Whereas if you, and especially if you can bat with someone else who's doing it at the other end, and the two of you are just, you know, regularly looking for singles, you know, putting pressure on with running, but hitting the ball into the gap, dropping the ball when you need to, and when you have a ball that you can hit for twos, if you can do that for a little while in club cricket, eventually the field just opens up and the bowlers start going for wickets and everything else. Bad balls always come. So if you can just look for singles and twos for a long period of time on a bad pitch, and this is probably also works for professional cricket, but if you can do it for a long period of time, eventually the bowlers have to chase. I played in a game a couple of years ago on a wicket that was just dreadful. The opposition made about 120, of which most of which were wides and no balls because the wicket was so wet that our bowlers kept falling over and bowling the ball everywhere. And we had to chase it. And it was so hard to hit a boundary on that. And so we lost about 3-4 early wickets. And a guy came out and I said, I know this is going to sound weird, and these bowlers probably look from the boundary like they're not bowling really well, but because of this pitch, just hit singles. We can get a single every single ball, right? Because the pitch is so slow that we can turn our wrists, we can open our wrists, you know, we can punch the ball, we can drop the ball. We'll be able to get a single almost any ball we want, right? And we'll get 3 or 4 and over, which is more than enough to get the chase. And I said, eventually what will happen is they will start to panic and start to bowl 4 wickets, you know, full on. And by the end of the game, we were getting, you know, they were trying to bowl short to us. You know, they were going for Yorkers and bowling full tosses. You know, all these sorts of things started happening. as you work through. And I think on bad wickets in club cricket, that's the easiest way to make runs.
Brian Lara used pot plants to work on his placement. John Wright glued his glove to his bat. Sachin Tendulkar dug up practice pitches. Tatenda Taibu cut the top off his bat. Claire Taylor used a hockey grip. Steve Smith was from tennis. Dean Jones would call phantom runs. And Victor Trumper turned the nets into a war zone to survive. The best batters in the world do whatever they have to make runs. We have told their stories in our new book, The Art of Batting.
Ali says, thoughts on Murali, 700 wickets in 2000s during the best batting era as an off spinner. Is he underrated in the GOAT discussion? Look, I mean, it's a complicated topic, right? Like, I think he's automatically in the GOAT discussion. His record is a bit weird compared to Warne's, just because Warne has what we would consider more of an international level career, right? And what Murali has is they kept playing the same teams over and over again quite a lot. And so there are just differences between the two of them. And I think it's a bit like Kumble in another era, even with his bowling average. Like, I think Anil Kumble doesn't get the same respect that Abdul Qadir does. And Abdul Qadir was the best spinner in his era, and Kumble is the third best spinner in his era. But I think pound for pound, and I love Abdul Qadir, I think you'd probably still take Kumble over him. I think they average about the same as well. But I think you take Kumble over him, right? So, you know, the era that you're in defines you, right? And we there's a modern day version of this is kind of like if the other player is from a bigger market, like Jimmy is probably as great a bowler as he is, probably slightly overrated, right? And Dale Steyn is probably slightly underrated. If you flip them around, Jimmy would be massively underrated and Dale would be massively overrated. But because of the markets they're in, whereas again, Australian cricket is dominating. It's the loudest voice. It's actually changing the game with limited overs cricket, like on and off the field, marketing and all these different things. And then you've got this new cricket nation, right, which is from a small country, which doesn't have a huge press or anything like that. On top of that, you have the complications over the bowling actions and everything else. So I just think there's lots of reasons why. But I mean, I think if you're having a conversation who the greatest bowlers are of all time, I think it'd be very rare for someone not to mention Murali. Mob says, is Henry Nicholls the Ollie Pope of New Zealand? Compare and contrast. Show a word. I'd be here all day, I think, doing that. I reckon, Mob, I'm trying to find it now. I think I've done an entire thing on Henry Nicholls. What would it be? Good. Just trying to see if it comes up. I think he might even be in one of my stats videos. But was he nominated for maybe most improved cricketer? And I got obsessed with him as well. My memory of Henry Nicholls is, and I can't find anything here, but he made all of his runs at home and none of his runs away. And it used to be very much that if you had anyone who could spin the ball, I think it was away from him, but it might have been in both directions, he really didn't go anywhere. And I think that he probably had a very blessed run when he started his career where he had a bunch of attacks that didn't have the things that troubled him. And then over time, he started to run into bowling attacks that could go up against him. This is my memory of Henry Nicholls. I don't remember the thought process though. Like, you can go back, you can find this on TalkSport, of me having a discussion with two Surrey guys, Batson and Butcher, where I said, I don't think Pope is going to be a great cricketer because, or at least the way he's currently set up, because he has these issues. Butcher goes nuts at me, and Bats and Butcher really upset I said that. And most of the things I said have come true. Some of which I didn't know at the time, but some other things have happened to him as well that I didn't know. And that's why I've done a big piece on him. I don't remember people telling me that Henry Nicholls is going to be the next big thing. I think they thought he would be a good player. So there's a very wide disparity between those. But there is. I understand your point of like, there was a time when everyone thought Henry Nicholls was going to be a New Zealand player for a long period of time, and then things happened. I think they both have very, very strong international level strengths, and they both have huge weaknesses. And so that's the kind of player they are. And that goes back to the conversations we've had before about, you know, can you minimize your weakness? And in Ollie Pope's case, he hasn't. Because Nicholls has been in and out. I haven't focused on him as much recently. But yeah. PJ says, if elite female keepers such as Sarah Taylor and Alyssa Healy played men's cricket as specialist keepers, how would they handle keeping to 150-kilometre deliveries? I think the bigger issue is probably not just the pace. I think it's the size of the ball. I think everyone forgets that the ball is different. And so I've never met, well, I've met Sarah. I don't think I've met Alyssa. I'd be shocked if they had big hands. Now, not all male wicketkeepers have big hands, but it's certainly an advantage to have larger hands when you are wicketkeeping. And if the ball gets bigger on you, I don't think the pace of the ball is the issue with fast bowling. I think the pace of the ball with spinners would be more of an issue for them. Because, yeah, I think that would be, I think that would cause more of an issue there. But I think, I don't know if you've ever seen this, PJ, before, but I've seen like club wicketkeepers, male and female, like at the professional level occasionally have to, you know, fill in and everything. Wicketkeeping is one of those skills, as I've said before, that actually seems to transpose quite well. So I don't think either of those women would, it depends on the hands, as I said before. They'd have to get used to the pace of the ball hitting their hands as well, but I don't think that would be as much of an issue as actually the size of the ball. And I think standing up at the stumps would cause a bit of an issue with the extra pace and bounce. And I think bounce might be their biggest issue, especially up at the stumps. So there's a lot of things that they would have to go with, but I don't think there's any reason to say that they wouldn't be able to do that. There are stories back as far as the 1800s about great women wicketkeepers, by the way. That is something that has always been talked about in cricket. And much of it might also be that women are shorter, and traditionally wicketkeepers were shorter, right? Lower to the ground, maybe more able. It might have something to do with the hips as well, but the ability to move from side to side. I don't know if those things all play a part. Ajit says, I've never been to a professional cricket match. Huh. But I've also seen lots of videos on social media about how poorly managed stadiums in India are and elsewhere. I know videos and pictures can be easily faked, but some of the things I've seen and heard are unclean washrooms. Check. Dirty, broken seats. Check. High priced. Sometimes, yeah. Scarce food and water. Check. Lack of shade and shelter. Check. Restricted mobility. Check. Poor crowd control leading to chaotic, dangerous exits. Check. And lack of accessibility. Check. That's a bingo, I believe the man said. How wise is continuing happening post the tragedy last year in Bengaluru? In other words, why didn't the BCCI use that as an opportunity to also inspect, renovate the problems in other stadiums? It's almost like they don't care about fans. I think we have a huge issue in cricket that we don't really care about fans. And so this isn't just India, although India certainly has a higher percentage of the things that you just mentioned there. I don't think you're going to get too many broken seats or dirty seats in the UK, right? I wouldn't have thought so in Australia either. Lack of shade at some grounds can be a problem in the UK. There's a ground around the corner from me that I love that ground. My God, there's no shade there for no reason at all. I do think that this is a problem. I think one of the big issues in cricket is that cricket grounds are very rarely owned by cricket boards. Right. So even in some of these other places where the facilities are better, it's very rare for any cricket grounds to be owned by cricket boards. Whereas I think the vast majority of football and American sports, there's either an owner and it's their job to make the stadium great so that people keep coming to it, or there is a, or it's owned by the teams or the same owners collectively. In cricket, you have governments who own cricket grounds. You have, you know, police and armed forces sometimes who are involved in it. It's run by amateur committees at times. All these little different things that you don't think about as a cricket fan, but all affect that. And specifically cricket grounds, stadiums in general, are not used enough because we spread out the games, especially at international level, so much that it's actually really hard to make your money back just as a cricket specialist stadium. Franchise cricket is changing that. And I do believe that certainly IPL franchises will start to build their own stadiums. I think RCB is the most likely to start there, but I think other teams have looked into this as well. I do think in other places as well, we'll be looking at similar kinds of things. Like, I know this is weird, and this is a ground that is quite nice, the Oval. Isn't that owned by like Prince Charles, King Charles? One of the Charleses? or like run by it, or do you know what I mean? Like there's so many weird complications within the way that cricket stadiums work, right? And that is not particularly easy for you to overcome or get around. But I also cannot state this enough. I do not believe the people who run cricket truly care about how comfortable cricket stadiums are for cricket fans in most countries in the world. The facilities are just unnecessarily shit. And as I was saying, I don't know if you saw this, Ajit, but me and Robbie were talking about this recently, and I was saying the corporate facilities aren't good. The corporate facilities at, say, Lord's are fine. They're okay. But I didn't feel like I was in the lap of luxury. It's a good view. Great view. You've got food and beverages and waiters, and things like that. It's good. I feel like I could get a lot better in, and I know I can, in American stadiums, and I've seen it in other places as well. So we're not even looking after the people who pay the big money. RCB, not RCB, Chinnaswamy is one that I've used the corporate facilities in. Okay. I've been to shit conference centers better than that, right? Like we just get so many things wrong in these grounds. And I do think there are complications, but I also think going ahead, we just need to be better. And so far as a sport, we haven't.
I once made a pair in a club game, which is almost impossible to do. But I have been obsessed with batting my entire life. And so I put that into my new book, The Art of Batting. Being that I'm not very good at that skill, I decided to talk to other people who were. So I hit up as many contacts as I could just to talk about batting. Rahul Dravid, Brian Lara, AB de Villiers, Kumar Sangakkara, Ross Taylor, Susie Bates, Nasser Hussain, Ian Chappell, and so many, many, many more. I wanted batters to talk about how they and their friends made runs, because that is the art of batting.
Look, as says, currently washy power play blocker, else Golbus role. Yeah, I think if the way I look at Washington Sundar is I like him at the coming in probably what overs 4, 5, and 6 to maximize the power play. He did it really well the other day, got a bit stuck after a while, but he's the only guy really doing it. Coming in, trying to hit boundaries, being a little bit reckless, got away with it, played some really nice shots. That makes sense for him. And then if that doesn't work, then you put him down at number 7, number 8. His numbers at the death are not too bad. So he either goes at the end of your batting lineup or he goes kind of at the beginning. I think the issue has been so far that him in the middle overs, he doesn't know how to make that work and he hasn't found a way to make that work. So I think with Washington Sundar, this happens with all-rounders all the time. They get promoted above their talent ability. And then they get to the position of playing professional cricket, and they've never actually really specialized in anything, or they haven't found a role, right? I was talking about this with Washington Sundar the other day. I was talking about Ben Stokes as a T20 cricketer. Could have been one of the best T20 cricketers of all time. No one ever found a role for him that made any sense. And so you end up in this really weird situation, where it didn't quite work for him. I don't know how to say your name, but India has clearly benefited from the impact player rule. Just look at the contrast between 2001 and 2022 and 2024 and 2026 after the impact player came in. I think this is causation versus correlation thing, because actually they were playing really, really attacking cricket and before the 2022 World Cup as well. And when they got to the World Cup, they slowed back down again. And in 2024, the full benefits of the impact sub weren't really, they had barely even come through. So I think you're just looking at it from that perspective, whereas actually they were already talking about this quite clearly. And if you go back, I did a 6-part video at the end of the 2022 World Cup on why I thought India were getting things wrong. This is before impact sub or anything else. And the Indian team and management looked at that and understood where I was coming from, and it's part of the implementation for them to continue to push forward, right? This isn't an impact sub thing. I don't think India particularly always play impact sub cricket at the international level anyway in this World Cup. I think there should be some advantages, but there's also more than enough international players around that should have a similar kind of advantage. Also, it causes problems for India, right? Their all-rounders aren't as developed as they should be. Washington Sundar, a very good case in point. By this point in his career, Washington Sundar should be an automatic starter and star on a T20 team. But in the Impact Sub era, it's harder to make him work, right? It's harder to make him work in that era where you can't get overs under his belt. So one of the big advantages India has is all these all-rounders, and all-rounders are no longer as important under the Impact Sub. So there are things that they lose from this that also cost them a little bit. I'm trying to think if it's affected their bowlers. I can't think if it's affected their bowlers. It's a bit like the IPL. I think the IPL helps India a lot. But could you come up with a system that could help them more, like allowing their players to play in a few leagues overseas, right? Yeah. But playing in the best league in the world also helps, right? So there are strengths and weaknesses in any of those plans, in any way that you look at this as well. Sorry to the person who's just spamming, but we don't do spamming as much as we can. Amarpreet says 60 for none is about power play at this point. It's actually par. It's a par power play. I think it's 62 runs. So let's not get too far ahead of ourselves. Also, different teams have different situations. Anons says, do you think RCB needs Jacob Ethel in place of Romario, as Romario gives close to nothing with the ball? What do you think Jacob Ethel is going to give with the ball? I think Romario makes perfect sense in the batting position for their team and where they would want him to play. I think Jacob Ethel would also go at 14 or 16 runs and over if he bowled in this league. And you're asking him to bat in a position that he's not particularly that well suited to. So you're asking him to find another new thing to come up with. It's not for me. That one. Why is RCB ahead of Punjab in your power rankings? So one of the main things is that RCB, we have seen them play against the best sides quite a bit so far. And I think we've got, let me just find there. Where are we here? They have lost to Delhi and Rajasthan, right? So Delhi has a plus side on from 3-2. I still think they're a good side, even if they're a bit weird at times. And Rajasthan were obviously absolutely on fire. Who's the best team that Punjab have played against? Probably Gujarat at this point, right? And so when we're doing the power rankings, we are not just looking at your record. We're looking at who you have played against, right? And so I think we find out a lot more in the next three games with Punjab when they go up against Delhi, Rajasthan, and Gujarat again. Whereas I think we know a little bit more about RCB at the moment. Like RCB almost beat Delhi, and the Rajasthan game was the one that got away from them. I don't think there's much in it. I think they're both tier one teams. I think you can go in either direction. But I just want to see Punjab play some better teams. I could have put them at number one this week. They're both in the same tier. I think people get very, very fascinated about like what ranking you have. The tier is more important. They both have a genuine side, a genuine chance to win the title. And, you know, I haven't seen anything there that has changed from that perspective. Just on the one before, I mean, not just the World Cup teams, even the players in the IPL are so different. Well, the players in the IPL are so different, but it is legit. Well, you actually brought up the World Cup. Do I think that India won the World Cup because of the Impact Sub rule? No. I think they were actually underperforming beforehand, and they realized why they're underperforming, and it was because they were not attacking enough with bat or with ball, which again, not particularly, the second one is not, you know, with bat, fine, you could say the Impact Sub played a part, but they actually had already worked that out before the Impact Sub had taken over. And two, the ball is not really the case. They needed to take more wickets and they've started to take more wickets. I think there's something there. Just have a look if there's anything else here. Chris says, how true is Robbie saying that Rahane's been hitting, it takes 2 weeks? Is that the same for Tillat? I don't know. You'd have to talk to, I mean, Robbie is a batting coach, and so he's probably, and would obviously have known Rahane for a long period of time. He has the ability to do that. Whether that 2 weeks is in season or out of season is also very tricky, especially when you're an IPL captain and everything else is going on. I think Rahane's been struggling with spin for a very long time. If Robbie can help him, I mean, in 2 weeks, that would be fascinating to me. But yeah, I there are probably some people who have an issue against one kind of bowling who could fix it almost straight away. And there are other people who maybe never could fix it, right? Like, I can't tell you, I'm not a batting coach, which is which. And that's something for someone like Robbie, who has worked with a lot of players at this stage. In fact, I think he's... I think one of the players he's been working with might have just got picked for the UAE squad. I think it was UAE. So well done to that young man whose name I've completely forgotten, and Robbie, whose name I can remember. Thank you very much to everyone for turning up for another Wagon Wheel. We'll be back again very, very soon for more of this kind of thing. In fact, we'll be back in a few minutes on this channel for a watch along. I won't be on it though. Others will be. Thank you for listening to this podcast on the Combox Network. There is an ad-free version of this you can find by supporting us on Patreon at Good Areas Podcast. You can also access our Discord channel there. Please like, subscribe, and rate this show. Every one of these helps us. If there was a guest on a show, you can find their links in the show notes. Huge thanks to Ruckshit, Ishit, and everyone else who helps us get our content out there. If you want to know more about us, head to combox.tv. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.